And welcome back to Blunt Business here on CannabisRio.com. Thank you all for joining us. If you haven't done so already, I highly recommend you either subscribe to the program in various ways. So find it wherever you find podcasts, wherever you listen to the program, whether it be Apple Podcasts, YouTube, YouTube Music, Spotify, Amazon. And also we put our shows on our Cannabis Radio channel on YouTube. So if you want to go and find that there, you can find the regular episodes every week on that channel. So make sure to like, comment, share, subscribe. We'd love for you to do that. And I'm happy to go welcome on a guest we had on last April here on the program. We're back once again, 1 year removed. She is an entrepreneur, investor, corporate deal maker with more than a decade of experience building and scaling businesses personally and professionally, has presented alongside Tony Robbins in the U.S. and Canada. And I don't know if this number has changed, but as of last check, 6 cannabis licenses she has that are minority or women-owned, has more than a decade of building and scaling, including a tech platform and turnkey retail model tailored to the cannabis industry. We welcome back the founder and CEO of CB Advisors, Sarah Gullickson. Sarah, thanks for coming on back and really great to have you on for another chat, especially with the home state of yours of Minnesota.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the intro. I'm sure a lot's changed since a year ago. As far as license counts and all that and what's legalizing, but I'm happy to get into it today.
So we did already discuss Minnesota initially on a program here in January. We like to have the opportunity to go ahead and look at what the new markets are doing and how they're sprouting up. There's been a lot of discussion on what Minnesota's been doing in terms of, they're getting a lot of it more in terms of home growth, in terms of the amount of plants you could have growing in the home and which ones have to be, you know, blossoming at one point, all these technicalities, the indigenous community, and the possibilities of, I believe, 11 tribes in the state that are able to go ahead and take advantage of the opportunities of adult use cannabis in the state. And let's go ahead and just give, for those that might have missed the program, if you didn't get a chance to catch it, my interview with David Stander with Greenspoon Martyr, we spoke initially about this, but of course, things have changed in the last 3 months. But to get everybody back up to speed, cannabis is now legal for adults 21 and older to use and possess. In the home state of Minnesota, where you are, it's the 23rd state in the country to legalize cannabis for adult use. And with that said, given the spotlight on Minnesota, you're going to be speaking about the launch of the adult use program at the Lucky Leaf Expo in April. You have a presentation that's said to be titled, How to Execute Your Operational Plans for a Successful Launch in Minnesota. So given that overview of what the state already has right now, what the adult use program looks like compared to other states, we have focused microscopically on New York, on Illinois, on New Jersey. I mean, name it. We have looked at the states and we've looked at what they're doing with their licensing, what they're doing with the process of bringing applicants up to light, getting them to go and open up stores, and also trying to curb that illicit market. What can you tell me about what you plan to speak about at that event?
So I'll have actually 2 speaking spots. So on Thursday, we're going to do like the operational crash course, which the operational crash course is really about what happens after you get a license. And I almost think it's important to do it in that order because a lot of times people think they're really interested in the cannabis license and don't even really understand what's on the other side of it, right? So how are you, you know, crafting your SOPs? What does this business actually really look like to run? So we'll be going into like the granularity of the business plan, the financial pro forma, how much cash it's actually going to take to do this. When are you expected to make a return on that cash that you're putting into this business? We'll be talking about real estate. And then, of course, going into, you know, marketing, grand opening. And we did a pretty similar show in New York when the card licenses were awarded. And it was a really, really awesome platform to talk about, hey, if you think you're interested in this, here's the real world picture of what this could potentially look like. And then on Saturday, we'll be talking more about like the application process and what that piece entails. There's a lot of crossover when you're talking about both of them, but one's more from like big picture standpoint, you know, request for proposal, request for application standpoint. And quite frankly, a lot of times when people are putting the application in, it takes, you know, the graders or the lottery a while to get the winners in. A lot of times that's a year afterwards. So things change between, you know, submission of application and then award of actual license, which then obviously gives you the green light to start with your operational plans. So those are the 2 sessions and the difference between the 2 sessions.
Yeah, it's a really, for those that are looking to go and make plans, especially right after visiting Hollywood, I would say, where Cannabis Radio most likely will be at, but right after that, only a couple weeks after. As you're listening to the program, if you haven't thought about making the last-minute plans to go and go to the Lucky Leaf Expo, website is luckyleafexpo.com, and Sarah will be speaking on, again, the all-day crash course, Thursday, April 25th, and speaking on April the 27th. Also, some pretty good names you have at the show. I saw two NFL players, Kyle Turley and Jim McMahon, are featured speakers of the event along with yourself. So in Minneapolis at the Convention Center, if you haven't done so, you know, if you're within driving distance, you can get a flight soon enough in time, get yourself set to go, you should do so. Make that point across. Now, as I mentioned at the start of the program, we spoke about the Minnesota cannabis market, and at the time we were looking at, in January, that the Office of Cannabis Management, which I believe we didn't have that name for that yet at that point, but now we do, they were looking to set up a licensing system for businesses so dispensaries won't open. And originally, the report was until sometime in early 2025. Well, WCCO, just as we were recording right now, as I did about a day ago, they have reported now the OCM is backing a bill that would make tweaks to the law to improve the licensing process, ensure timely market launch, and regulate effectively. But there's a proposed change now that the agency might approve who receives a state license to open cannabis business, sparking a fierce debate, they say. So the current law in place now instructs the office to create a point system for reviewing business license applications. Regulators would consider criteria like experience in the cannabis industry and business and safety plans, among others. If the owner meets the definition of a social equity applicant, quote unquote, the application is given a boost in scoring, an effort to keep, reach a key goal set by bill authors and advocates who want Minnesotans disproportionately impacted by cannabis prohibition an opportunity to cash in on legalization. So before I ask real quick, Sarah, we have seen various methods go on. And what I'm seeing is, I'm just saying it myself without anybody else saying this, that the social equity application process, the licensing process, it leaves loopholes to some possible corruption where we've already heard stories, you know, first-person accounts about how if an applicant cannot meet the financial needs to go and be able to go and bring the dispensary up to market, that they can sell it off and very well an MSO or someone else, you know, that's not a social equity applicant won't get the license. We've seen the issues where, you know, there's various systems that come into play that make it difficult for a social equity licensee that has all the proper merits and all the proper wherewithal to be able to get a license might miss out on it. The system is not perfect, but what do you think about possible changes and what the licensing process is in Minnesota and how important it is to try to be able to find that status of being a social equity applicant?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously the conversation around this is a real and a raw conversation. For me, I've seen so much in the industry that I kind of sit on the other side of the fence where should social equity applicants be able to apply? Absolutely. Are a lot of social equity applicants able to also fund the business? In my experience, that hasn't been the case. So we kind of moved away from diversity, minority, and we've really ruled that out in a lot of the different markets. And now we're working on social equity, which in theory is great, right? Let's give everybody an opportunity to go for one of these licenses. Mm-hmm. But to your point of loopholes in the system, I don't necessarily view it that way. I don't know that it's a loophole. I think that, you know, a lot of the social equity licenses have a holding period, and that's, you know, the remainder of time that the social equity person needs to be in control. But if the social equity person has the resources and the funding to actually get the application in and get the license on the other side of it, they're just like me. They're just like you. They're just like most business people where they're going to have to go and raise capital. How do you raise capital in the cannabis industry? You don't go to a bank. You don't go to a fund. You go to individuals. So what do individuals want for that cash? They want equity in the business. So it's this, you know, it's this endless conversation of, you know, what is the solution? In my opinion, we've had a lot of best case scenarios where either, you know, our firm or investors or different people will fund the application process, you know, with and for the social equity applicant. And that's in order to go into the business venture together And then whoever's funding it usually ends up being the lending source for actually opening the business. All social equity people aren't created the same in the sense they're just like you and I. They have different backgrounds. They have different skill sets and things like that. So I think the challenging part is, you know, this control. So the social equity person has the control. If there's not a business background attached to it, you know, who knows what that looks like. So it is, and I know that that's not a popular opinion, but I've been working in this space and we've gotten dozens of social equity licenses now across the country over the last, 4 or 5 years that this has become a topic. And, you know, I think it's frustrating for both sides because, you know, the person that's laying down, you can't open a dispensary for less than usually $2 million bucks. You know, coming in, it's risky. It's risky for both sides. And then the other side of it, I think that when a social equity person has the wherewithal and the foresight and the understanding and gets an application in, and then, you know, maybe they get it a year later and decide things change for them and they don't necessarily want to be a part of it, then they should sell it. I do that all the time. So what's wrong with that? You get a license and you sell a license and you make money. So I understand what you're saying about like the corrupt part of it where there's like license being stolen and people are, you know, playing art of war. I don't agree with that. I agree with putting a business model together that actually works. So in New York, we were super excited about it because there was an actual fund that we could go to. And then that obviously imploded in 17 different ways. So in my opinion, if there is a solution to keep social equity applicants in control, it would be a version of what New York did where there's a fund attached to it and not a fund set up to say, all these people are going to fail. And when they do fail, we're going to take all their licenses. And then the fund's going to be worth not $200 million. It's going to be worth $1 billion because we took all the licenses from the social equity people. So, you know, I just think I've seen too much to have this like overly optimistic idea of what this is and what it isn't.
I'm going to unpack a few things on that. And I will scale back a little bit on the fact that I didn't want to make it where if I'm saying a loophole, it's just that there are ways that the licensee, once they get that license, that they can be compromised. And in right. some of the areas, all I know is that successful social equity applicants that have gone through the process, and there have been some cases where they just meet the criteria, but they don't necessarily need to have the status. They could just go ahead and get a license of their own, you know, outright. Because they have the business acumen, they have the capital. We've had enough of folks that have been on with us that don't have that issue at all. But if the opportunity, you know, offers itself, they're going to take it. Why not? I mean, it would be just right and smart business. The other applicants might have an issue where they might not have that business acumen. They don't realize, okay, there's going to be something coming up where if you take this grant from, say, this public-private partnership from, like, say, New York, right, Chicago Atlantic, 13 to 14% interest rates. That's you're going to have to pay back on that loan. You're not going to be aware of how much you're going to be able to have on that. Then there's delays of the process where I don't know if Minnesota might, you know, have any issues where if the permits, you know, the inspection process might take any delays to get a building up and ready to be inspected and get the cultivation up to specs. The other thing, too, is that, you know, while there are licenses that can be brought in as social equity licenses, it's like you said, yeah, absolutely. Anybody can go and come on board and go ahead and sell it off to somebody else. But there was that whole intent of that social equity license being meant to be held by a social equity applicant. So right. it can, and for the fact it can be passed off to somebody else is another issue. The other thing, too, is legacy operators and their barrier to entry, meaning the chance that if you want to curb the illicit market, why don't you give a gateway, a pathway to legitimate ownership for legacy operators? Is that something that's also be considered as well? These are the things we've been talking about a lot on the program, and it's those areas where that's where I'm coming from, where maybe loophole is a very strong term, and I agree with you where it comes through that. I think a lot of this is not maybe more my sort of incidents. It's not a pandemic. It's not like some widespread issue, but this is where the government entities, these cannabis control boards, never really had the thought of all this, or is this something where maybe you know, the tax revenue they might get from the cannabis industry isn't all that they want.
Right. Yeah, and I think that you make a good point. So it's like if we want people in the industry that are social equity, you know, are the social equity programs crafted to create a revenue stream for social equity people, or are they created to keep social equity people in the industry for years to come, kind of a thing. Because in my opinion, if somebody has a social equity license, they decide they don't want to run it, want to get somebody else involved, at that point, they're making great money off of the sale of a license. So I don't know if that's a bad thing or not. Now, if the intent of the program is to have, you know, social equity people run them and have them and pass them down to their family, I mean, they can't put that in the legislation. So it is, I wish that the government, to be honest, and this is, again, probably an unpopular opinion, I wish that they would create some sort of a framework within the legislation to acknowledge and understand that if there is a lending source that has to come in with social equity applicant or entity, to do it in a way that there's parameters in place where everybody is set up for protections, everybody's set up for success, right? Because that's just the nature of the beast. I mean, sure, you talk about, you know, certain social equity applicant, you know, having the funding and the business acumen, and there's of course a segment of the market that has that, but there's also a segment of the market that doesn't have that. So the question at that point is, should they all be shut out and only the people that can do it 100% for themselves only be let in? So, you know, it's a new thing. We can't poke so many holes in it. Everybody's trying to figure out what the best blend of regulations is and are. You know, I can tell you in Missouri, they thought that they were doing the best thing and they did a social equity program. But then they said, oh, OK, just kidding, social equity people, you guys can only play together, but you can't play with any of the big guys, which makes like no sense.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, again, cannabis is still so new from like a normal licensing perspective. And now we're adding a different element on top of it that has so many different idiosyncrasies. And quite frankly, there's not.
Lowe's knows that free makes everything better. That's why our rewards members get free standard shipping on the things they need and want, starting at Silver Key status every day. Savings for rewards members add up fast, so why wait? Join for free today. Lowe's, we help, you save. Not available in Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/shipping terms. Subject to change.
A path forward of one best way to do it.
There's a lot of new states coming into play. And some of those, you know, when we look at, you know, the political spectrum of where, you know, if they're a red state or a blue state, we're seeing a couple of red states now coming into play. Ohio is now, it's already launched. Florida has a potential ballot initiative. We're supposed to be talking with another guest that'll soon talk to us about the changes that are going on there. We're just waiting for the Supreme Court of Florida, where I'm at, to finally allow the terminology, to allow the petitions and the ballot initiative to finally go into the 2024 ballot. So as soon as it goes there, I honestly have full faith that it'll get passed with 2/3 majority and Florida will be adult use. Same thing for Pennsylvania, because then the governor could just go ahead and sign it if the legislature can get the bill done. So they're not the wait for ballot initiative. They could just go and grab it in. So all these states, they're also going to go through their own issues with social equity. They might have a different take on what they're going to do, but it's all in the goal of, if people want federal legalization down the line, and enough of the happy talk, I say it's 3 to 5 years down the line, you have to wait for a supermajority of House and Senate in Congress in D.C. for that to be possible. That's where I believe it is. I mean, no matter how many more bills can be written and presented, but if they're not going up for a vote, don't even worry about it right now. What needs to be done is the House for cannabis internally has to be uniform. We have to have everything down from compliance to how these licenses are being doled out, to be able to have plans in place proactively so that the industry will be ready to be passed off to federal oversight down the line. And this is something where I'm going to keep on this program to talk about that, because other companies might have their issues, because, you know, maybe other podcasts out there, they have the people they have to go be answering to. For me, I'm just a journalist here. I can go ahead and speak out and say, listen, this is what I see this industry from talking to all these people, 360 some odd episodes. It's a matter of, if the industry is going to be successful for the long term, we have to look past what short-term goals we have right now and have a framework set in place and all these different aspects so that federal oversight is just oversight. You do not want the federal government to be entrenched and add more agencies and things like that. Look at just what they're scheduling right now, waiting for that to be done. Or waiting for decriminalization. Another thing, hey, great organizations want to have that happen, but that is not reality. We need to be worrying about getting our store in full and tip-top shape, and then we can open the door and Federal will be ready for us because this industry will be ready. It's responsibility and accountability across the board. Mm-hmm. I'm here again with Sarah Gullickson, the CEO of CB Advisors here on Blunt Business. We're going to be back with more questions, more about the social equity process in Minnesota, because there is also the suggestion of a lottery system and what policymakers are saying about it. Plus, we need to get a fall back up on what's been going on in other states, and that also there are those in Minnesota that are speaking out about where social equity has not done a full favor for those that have been, you know, oppressed or have been, you know, misrepresented in every industry, and having a chance to again have this opportunity at entrepreneurial success. Be back with Sarah and more questions after this.
Rolling into some sponsors, but we'll be right back with more Blunt Business.
Welcome back. I'm here once again on Blunt Business with Sarah Gullickson, founder and CEO from CB Advisors. Sarah, we were just talking about social equity before the break, and know more from the WCCO story that I mentioned before about social equity and some of the changes they're looking to go ahead and make now that they're looking at the application process. Minnesota's House and Senate committees are suggesting a lottery system instead. Charlene Briner, the interim cannabis office director, she says, quote, "There is an inherent advantage for well-funded applicants who have the means to prepare an application in accordance with the subjective and non-subjective criteria in the process. A merit-based system favors folks who already know how to strategize a subjective system or will have the means to hire a consultant or an attorney who knows how to navigate that," end quote. So as I mentioned already, we were talking about instances where there could be some possible corruption. We're not saying it's in a wide scale or anything like that, but here on Blunt Business, we talked about social equity in both models of, say, the merit-based system or a lottery system or scoring. So when you're talking, say, to anyone in Minnesota and the plan, if they want to be a social equity applicant, you know, what should they plan on? Or if they're not going to be a social equity applicant, but they realize how many licenses are going to be doled out that they're not going to be able to participate in or be able to acquire, what do you say to them?
Those are interesting quotes, right? Because when we're talking about merit, you have to have more funding, right?
Right.
When we're talking about lottery, it leaves whoever gets the licenses up almost to dumb luck, right? So that conversation is like an interesting one to me, because if you don't have enough money to put a merit-based application in, do you have enough money to actually open a cannabis business?
Right.
So it's kind of like what comes first, the chicken or the egg, right? So I hear both sides, and I understand the conversation. You know, lottery is a masses approach. They're going to get a ton of applicants. They're going to get a ton of application fees, which are usually non-refundable.
Didn't know that.
Of course they do.
Wow. Now, what are the fees are we looking at? What's the average you would say that they have to go and already invest in that deposit, basically, that doesn't get returned?
So our app fees in Minnesota, from micro business to a combination business, which is less of a social equity business, range from $500 to $10,000. So it's a very large range.
Yeah.
So, and I think that honestly, the separation of licenses, meaning when you have more license types, is good for a social equity type like playing field, right? So when you're trying to open a vertical business, I mean, you need $20 million. That's crazy. That shouldn't be a social equity license. Or for Minnesota, they're calling it a combination, I believe. You know, so, but cultivators, 10,000, manufacturers, 10,000, retailers, 2,500. So these are heavy fees. This is not small fees. When we're in other social equity states, like around 1,000 is about the sweet spot for a social equity application. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a lot of fees. So if you want to run a lottery, you're going to make a lot of money in fees. If you want to run a merit-based application, you're obviously going to get a ton less applicants, right, depending on what the merit criterion is. So we've seen, you know, a hybrid, and we call that more of like a checklist process. So you have to submit your business plans. You have to submit your SOPs. You have to submit standard operating procedures. You have to submit certain pieces of information to meet the criterion, and then you're accepted into the lottery. So, you know, I used to preach at every single And to anyone that would listen to me, merit-based. And I still believe merit-based application processes get the best qualified applicants, social equity, minority, or just regular license types, because you have to actually show what you're going to do, right? But they've tried to strip it down. They've tried to make it more affordable. And so that's when these lottery processes came in place, which you, at that point, you don't get the best qualified person. You get who the lottery numbers go to, right? So, you know, it's just, again, there's not like one model that makes the most sense when we're talking about this. Like if I had to custom craft a model and sit down and spend some time and do it, I could probably do it. But at this point, you know, we just follow what happens, right? So we'll try and lobby a little bit. We'll try and sharpen our tools. We'll try and talk to some of the legislators to say, or some of the people that are on the committee to make the rules, like, you know, here's what we've seen work. Here's what we've not seen work. And here's some like anecdotal stories that you can listen to of, you know, social equity applicants that either, you know, did a great job or got their licenses taken from them. And here's the things that we like to consider. And then they have to kind of go back and see what they're comfortable with. But when the fees are in place, like a lottery system makes sense because they start their cannabis fund and their program with millions and millions of dollars in it because there were so many applicants.
In terms of if they get to the license and they're able to go and get themselves forward, the funding would have to be, I guess, what the grant is being allotted by the state, because you know, there's still no banking regulations that allow the part. I mean, under Minnesota's Commerce Cannabis Banking Guidance, they still say, well, I mean, no matter what, if a bank or a credit union or whatever, any financial institution that wants to offer cannabis banking services, they still have to follow the regulations when it comes by the Controlled Substances Act, FinCEN, BSA, and the DOJ's Cole Memo. Like, they still have to follow that. Like, I mean, how many banks are going to be willing to go ahead and step forward to offer any kind of loan solutions at all to any cannabis companies that are going to be opening up, especially those that are social equity applicants? I mean, that's the part where you're beholden to the state to get the funding unless you can find private investors. There's
point,
a workaround
the
to it.
Rate?
Absolutely, and that's every state, by the way. That's another thing that was never considered with social equity. You know, we're still doing this without the banking guidance. Very little, if any, in certain states you might have, maybe Oklahoma or Texas or you know, some others, but really it's limited on how many they're going to, and on top of that, with the limited amount of banks, limited amount of loans they'll be able to offer, and who might be allowed to them. They're not going to just take anybody, and they're just not going to be forced to take someone because there's social equity. Doesn't matter
right.
to them either.
And then your credentials come into play, so they should have just picked the people that put the best merit-based application in place anyway. So at some point, you're going to get there.
It's larger,
either with the government and either with the bank, either with, I mean, your investors, like, you're going to end up there.
This is all these things that I mean, and I only bring this up because I think it's, okay, it's always about this, the do-good attitude, but then it's also performative, because when you look at, the headlines look good when you hear about this, but this is what we're talking about, the more internal, the actual details, the devil's in the details. You look at what's going on here, and you see, and I'm just bringing this across, it's by all means the most popular topic to talk about here, but you know what? It's necessary. It's a necessary thing for us to talk about social equity in this program. And I know I've talked about it a lot this year because it's important. And if we want to have that, there's all the same different scenarios that come across, and we could talk to as many as we want. But I know that, you know, like you said, how many people do we know of, if there's a count on how many of those have actually spent fees just to be denied and declined it? Oh, here, $10,000. Here you go, Minnesota.
Right.
Free lunch. That's great. And taking from those that don't have the money, you would think, right? Because, where did they get that money from? You know, how much of a dent is that going to be able to make on them that they just took a gamble? And it's like, well, there's a lottery system. The one you lose. Like, who gets the money?
Right.
Where does that money? How about this? Do they ever even say anything about where the fees go to? Is it just going to be pocketed? Why don't they put that back into the grant? Like, that'd be nice. If you're going to say, you need to put the money into the grant. You just can't keep doling out from the budget. Then take the fees from those that are declined. Why don't you put that into the social equity fund?
Right.
That sounds like a pretty.
And then fair. It'll only fund, 20% of them. And then we're back to merit. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, honestly,
like, Right.
Honestly, there's these new states that are just doing social equity. And I think diversity should get called back into the industry. I absolutely think that there should be a license type for women, minorities. Like, why did they take that out? Right. And then maybe there's a smaller segment that's, you know, for social equity. And then there's a larger segment of the licensing that is, you know, for regular people that can show that they have like a funded business and they have, you know, 10 people willing to put 2 million or 10 million or 80 million or whatever it's going to cost in. You know, it's kind of weird. Like most of my licenses, not anymore, were, you know, women or African-American or whatever our like, you know, parameters were for whatever that, you know, investment group was that we, you know, ended up doing the license with. But we don't have those anymore because they've pretty much taken them away in most of the states, which why? I mean.
And part of the thing is that you would think that other states that have already maybe instituted, they might have added on or made modifications to their programs, like say a Colorado or a California or Washington or Oregon, the very first states, they might have gone in and said, well, we're going to revisit social equity. We're going to go revisit areas where we could do that. I, you know, talked to someone right now who's now with that Drug Policy Alliance, but she was with City of Los Angeles and helped to do the licensing process to get, what, 700 some odd licenses passed. But still, all the applications that come in, it's a burden to go through all this. And, you know, the constant pressure of, like, how many are social equity? And, you know, the other thing, too, is that it's that upkeep of process of getting the licenses on board. And if you can't get somebody to go ahead and take the license because of the plan that you want to have so many licensed dispensaries everywhere, but then you have these social equity licensees that are not going to be able to make it, you're going to underserve the public because you're not going to have enough stores to service the area. So right. Who takes that? The MSOs are going to just take their big superstores, whatever they're going to do, in their major markets. And, you know, that's another part where when those dispensaries can't be opened, the ones that can are the ones that are going to have to, don't even worry about it because they have the cash they have. They don't have to go to the social equity. They could just be that other minority percentage, but they'll have all their stores open in time.
Right. Yeah, because the people that have the funding get open first. I mean, that's just the reality of it. Like a lot of times the MSOs already have the real estate bought, built out, you know, you name it, and they're ready to like attach their license to it day one. I mean, that's just a lot of times that's their approach in a new market.
Or they're the indigenous tribes that you're just going to open right up because they don't have any kind of rules. Or they're not beholden to any of the state government rules. You can just open right up right now. So what? The second indigenous adult use dispensary is already opening up. So they're already set to go. They don't have to wait for anything right now.
Right.
Now, in terms of who gets the opportunity to get a license, we're going to take us straight from here. WCCO also brought up a story where they referenced this might have been from the Minnesota Black Chamber of Commerce, by the way. They referred to the Arizona Center on Investigative Reporting that last year, they reported that 42% of social equity license lottery winners in Arizona are owned by corporate dispensaries 2 years after the state's program launched. This, I think, was August 2023, they reported that. Now, Nathan Young, who is the cannabis policy lead for the Minnesota Black Chamber of Commerce, responded to this stat in particular and stated, quote, "This is not only unfair for the unassuming black entrepreneurs who fall victim to the scheme, it is deeply unfair to the numerous black entrepreneurs, many of whom are already working on their business plans, who worked hard to build a viable business, only to lose on chance to a big business who cheated their way in." Now, the other thing we're going to make mention of here is that the OCM-backed bill we're talking about now, they're looking at establishing temporary licenses, which if approved would open applications as early as this summer, and it would ensure businesses are ready to go by early next year when regulators hope the legal market will be ready to launch. Only social equity applicants will be eligible for these temporary licenses, a set number of them, and there will be a lottery for those as well. And if businesses with a temporary license are in good standing, they could convert into official licenses once the state opens up the general applications to become a state-approved grower, manufacturer, or retailer following completion of rulemaking. So now, this is another part where, like, okay, we're going to put another fiery hoop in front of the process, another obstacle, another hurdle in place. Now, just to make mention of, CB Advisors have secured over 75 licenses nationwide, so you and your team would definitely be adept to understanding this. But how would you look at consulting these temporary licenses? When you look at this right here, you know, is that another fee process? I mean, what is this entailing that you see? And have you had anybody that's looking to go ahead and possibly enter into the program to get one of these temporary licenses?
Yeah, so that's a lot to unpack. So the Arizona stat compared to the Minnesota stat is just not apples to apples, because Arizona is a full vertical license. So to open a vertical license, you're looking at least $10 million. I don't know many people that just have $10 million to open it by themselves.
Right.
So they had to call in the big dogs. That was just the way that the Arizona program needed to work if it was going to work. And then when we're talking about...
Just to make a point, I think what Nathan was just... He was trying to use that as a caveat just to say the most extreme case. But like you're saying, Minnesota's a different story.
Totally, because once you're segmenting licenses out and allowing for transport, it makes the budgets of each individual license more granular, right? You're taking that $10 million number, $20 million number, and then in essence dividing it by, eight different license types or whatever it is. So that's interesting. And then the other part of it with the temporary license, I mean, I don't know that that's like a terrible idea, but that's what they tried to do in New York. And then there was litigation, and all of us that had card licenses and that were ready to open couldn't open. Some people were paying rent. So that's like another nightmare to discuss. So in theory, I don't think that the temporary license, or like in Ohio, they did, and this was back when diversity was in place, you could have a micro grow, and it was like, let's call it 5,000 square feet. I don't remember how much it was supposed to be. And then once you proved over time that you were compliant and that you were a good operator and you were all the things, and after a period of time passed, you could upgrade or add square footage to your grow. At that point, maybe that makes sense. Do you know what I mean? And then at that point, can you bring investors in to, help you build it out? I don't know. It seems like a lot of these social equity programs are like, we don't want investors, but like, guess what? I've made a lot of money in the cannabis industry and I have investors for all of my projects. What's the problem?
Right.
I'm not going to take my kids' college funds and be like, oh, okay, I'm going to put it into this one.
They're saying a temporary license,
kind of
what New York did with a temporary inspection, like they would get a temporary license to open a pop-up dispensary, a temporary space, until the inspection on the final building can be done. So again,
right,
that was always that extra part where you just need another place to go ahead and house your store until we pass the license, the inspections for the new store that you get. Like, that's another thing where like, okay, so we have to open up and go to another property before we can go to our actual property. We just can't go right to it.
Right. But then at that point, like, how long are you signing a lease with your temporary property to then like cut your lease off? Like, come on, guys. You know what I mean? So I think, and the reason I brought New York up is because the problem everybody had with New York is that diversity wasn't included. Regular people weren't included. So it was unjust to everybody but the social equity people. And that's ultimately what ended up halting it. So is this unjust to have people that are only social equity be able to do the temporary license? Like, I don't have an answer for that, and I don't even actually have an opinion. I just, like, that's what we've seen happen in the past. And, these governments that are putting it together, the OCM or the agencies, their number one thing they don't want to happen is litigation. So the more complex you make the programming, the more favorable you put one certain group up on a pedestal or not, somebody's going to file a lawsuit. I mean, we've watched it every single state process.
And just so you know, now we've talked about New York a little bit here, but it's funny that, New York is trying to go ahead and overhaul their whole process. Their licensing process right now, Jeanette Moy, Commissioner of Office of General Services from the New York Times, by the way, they're trying to shorten the time to process applications to get businesses open. And the OCM right now, recommending applicants to the board for final approval. They got 7,000 applications for licenses last fall, and only 109 have been opened so far this year. And the agency has just 32 people assigned to evaluate the application. So, yeah, they're overwhelmed with the application process. They can't get enough to open. That's like, that ratio is horrible. And, Governor Hochul's like, she's just pointing the finger at everybody else. Oh, so you're telling me the control board, that's not the problem. They're not the ones that like made the mistake. What they're calling the legal cannabis launch, a disaster.
It is a disaster.
Whose fault is that?
Absolute disaster.
Does it matter?
Does it matter?
Project? Come on.
Did you see the proximity map?
No.
Oh, it's quite interesting. Because like when we're talking about it, it's like he who has the most money can open up the store and get the lease in New York quickest, right? And then once you get your, you know, proximity locator, you have a protective bubble around you of 1,000 feet. Well, that's huge in New York. So New York isn't traditionally supposed to be like limited license. They're only giving them out 250, 250, 250. But it will be a limited license state because of the fact that in the city, everybody's on top of each other. So that's also another thing where we had applicants that had leases, had the property ready to go. And in the lottery system, it ended up being, you know, 20 down the line from the other guy that wanted to open in the space next to you. And then guess what? You don't have a license anymore. You get a provisional and you have to go back to the drawing board and find real estate. So, I mean, listen, cannabis is so hard. And I've been in it 14 years.
Right.
And so if I'm telling anyone anything, it's like you really have to understand what you're getting into. You really have to understand the capital requirements, the grit, the dedication. This isn't like opening a normal business. And I wish that I would be able to say that it was, you know, 14 years after getting into the industry, but it's just not. It is. There's so many different idiosyncrasies. So, you know, I'm obviously we're talking today and I'm just really realistic about it. I'm not negative. I'm just realistic. Like there's so many different loopholes that you have to go through. And since I've seen a lot of things in the industry, the good, the bad and the ugly, like that's why I'm here. And that's why I'm a consultant. And like we interview people to say, like, we won't take people that don't have what it takes, because why would we bang our head against the wall? It just doesn't make any sense. And so that's why with social equity, we've felt strongly about the sweet spot being with, hey, social equity person, you're qualified. Do you have business acumen? Yes or no. Do you have money? Yes or no. Okay, if the answer to both of those questions is no, here's somebody that can fund it for you. Do you want to do that deal or not?
Right. And then on top of the fact of what they've been able to get licensed. Okay, so what was the system? Remember 2022, they say here, 85 legal stores opened across the state. But yet 1,500 set up shop illegally in New York City alone. Like, you're not helping the matters any. You're causing the process where then the resources that you could have had as well towards, you know, maybe the social equity investment fund for CURDs, for instance, in New York, or pick another state. The money that's going to be used by law enforcement or federal authorities now to go ahead and go crack down on illicit markets because this new opening of adult use legalization has been allowed. So now you get a lot of bad actors deciding to go get on the process. So
it's crazy. I was in New York June of last year. Mm-hmm. And it was like after we had got the card license, because I had a card license.
Yeah.
And I was like terrified because I'm like, if this illicit market keeps up, the normal license that actually have paid the piper, that have, are going to have to pay taxes, are going to have to pay rent. Rent in New York is insane, right?
Exorbitant.
And like, you're not even going to be able to like make it, because there, like, even when I was there, and I don't know if it's changed since I've been there, it was almost like, you know, what, a year ago now? Yeah. There was a store, and I'm putting quotes around store, like literally everywhere you look, you couldn't tell the real ones versus the fake ones. Like,
oh, yeah.
some of the ones that were illegal were like so nice that you would think that they were real. And how are you going to educate the population on, oh, don't go into the bad ones or the illegal ones? People don't care, especially tourists that aren't like there. They're just like, oh, this looks like a normal place.
Yeah. I was in New York exactly 1 year ago today as we record. And yeah, just seeing all the different shops all nicely lit with a cannabis leaf on it. You can find those every block. It was all over the Upper West Side of Manhattan. It's like you can't miss them.
I went into a bodega just to get like gum and, you know, a water. And I looked down and there's like can the beverage.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like an infused beverage. Right. And I looked down and I was like, oh, and I took it and I like bought it. Cause I was like, let's give this a whirl. There was nothing in it. So there's like, you know what I mean? And you could tell like from the, the labeling that it was like so jimmy rigged.
Oh my
God. So I think I drank like a sparkling water, which great. It quenched my thirst. But it didn't.
That is wild.
What it needed to do. So yeah, there it's everywhere in New York. Everywhere.
I mean, and they're fearless over there. This ruthless over there. It's amazing, but no answers for that. So you know, the governor wants to go ahead and talk about this. I don't know if she's up for a re-election. That's why she's creating a stir or whatever. But like the thing is now, this is where every government entity, if you're going to rely on this, and I will say this like, on top of that, we're going to come back to, we're going to do another break and then we're going to come on back. But I want to make this point that you can't expect all these government cannabis control boards to create a system which will be substandard. That's what they're all doing. They're not going to do anything in terms of compliance or curbing the illicit market. That's not going to be just, okay, the bare minimum of what's being done. This has to get fixed. And this is where the business owners have to go and be much more vocal. And if you can do it in a state like Minnesota, it's just initiating the process. They want to get ready and up and going by 2025. We're going to talk about what the governor's talking about with that. But somebody needs to get into his head and say, listen, you just, you know, and from the perspective of, listen, we know you're going to want to make money off of this. I know. But billions of dollars of tax revenue, absolutely. You know it's going to happen. $5 million right now in New York alone so far with all the mess that they already have. But imagine if you did it right. Again, it's like if it was well-regulated, well-organized, imagine how much money could be going into the state and working out so well. So let's talk about that coming up after a short break. Again, I'm here with Sarah Gullickson, founder and CEO of CB Advisors, Cannabis Business Advisors. And we're back with final questions after this.
Rolling into some sponsors, but we'll be right back with more Blunt Business.
And welcome back to Blunt Business. I'm here again with Sarah Gullickson, founder and CEO of CB Advisors. So before the break, I mentioned Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. He was on Minnesota Public Radio in January talking about the launch of the adult use program. And he says he's aiming to get cannabis dispensaries open in early 2025 and that the Office of Cannabis Management is currently working with a contractor to develop an online licensing application system. We were just talking about this before the break. And he reaffirmed the project predicted deadline to open dispensary doors, adding that a goal to get the illicit stuff off the street in favor of regulated products. And in the bigger picture, the OCM aims to license 381 dispensaries worldwide. I've seen some reports they were predicting they need to have 400 plus and to reserve at least 51% of licenses for social equity applicants. So with that said, I mean, what do you think so far about the process that's been put together so far and what is being planned right now for the state of Minnesota, you know, compared to other states? What do you think of what your home state's done so far in this process?
Like back to the beginning or right now?
Where we are right now with what they plan to do to get the licensing process, to get the adult use program up and going, what possibilities they have or what they're going to make.
I honestly like the granular license types. I think that it gives everybody a shot at, you know, potentially being in this space. So like the transporter license, like you only, we've done the financial model on it and it's like, you know, barrier to entry is around 500, 600,000. That's not bad, right? Now, can you turn that into, you know, a family business or a business that's going to like pay your bills? I don't know about that yet. But I think that the rollout is, you know, I pay less attention to like the fatal errors of the program just because at some point it gets too far down where it's like you don't, one person or two people or 10 people don't have the power to change it, right? So you have to function within the parameters that are like put out. I think they've done an okay job. I think Minnesota has a bigger problem than we've even discussed today. And that's, you know, with what's going on with their like hemp program and with restaurants being able to carry Delta 8 or Delta 9. One of my best, closest girlfriends growing up, we went to high school together at Lake Minnetonka area. She's a pharmacist and she runs the poison control for Minnesota, North Dakota and South Dakota. And she actually, we've used her a couple times in different states to discuss what's happened in Minnesota and what's like happened as far as like the influx of kids getting unregulated products, thinking that it's not something that's going to be severely intoxicating, and then kids are ending up like dead, basically. So you have a THC program that's trying to roll out, but what are they going to do with this, you know, Delta 8, Delta 9 situation where they're in all the convenience stores and where you can get it? Like my mom took my grandma to a lunch one day and they were advertising that they had like THC beer. And it's like, so where's the regulation with that? So if everybody's going to be spending millions and millions and millions of dollars to get their cannabis THC businesses set up, And then we're going to be able to still allow, you know, Delta 8 and Delta 9 intoxicating products. So I think that's what I see as the biggest. It's not from a programming standpoint. It's not from a fee standpoint. It's not from a social equity standpoint. That to me is the biggest problem.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll have more discussions about Minnesota in the coming months, and we'll see if anything else changes about it. But I'm, of course, you're here in Blunt Business. So if anything else changes about it, you'll know, you'll hear it from me first, and we'll talk about it, probably with the guests out there. And obviously, Sarah, as always, we want to go ahead and keep the door open to always have you back on. And I'm so glad you had a chance to go and join us once again. So I want to just make sure to remind folks, as we approach the Lucky Leaf Expo, which, you know, as we record this show, this should be a real, be pushed out right before the event, April 25th to the 27th, you'll be featured in the day-long crash course, a pre-show event crash course, and then you'll be speaking on a presentation titled How to Execute Your Operational Plans for a Successful Launch in Minnesota. So before I get to anything else, go ahead and just let me know, you know, if there's anything else you want to make mention of in terms of your appearance and how people can continue to go ahead and work with you and your team at CB Advisors.
Absolutely. So the cannabisbusinessadvisors.com, otherwise I have a personal website, sarahgallatin.com. And I'm super excited to be coming back to Minnesota. Obviously, there's certain things that we're going to have to get through to make sure that this is a, you know, solid and safe program for everybody, investors and consumers. But, you know, we've accomplished a lot in the past, and I'm sure that, you know, we can put something together that, you know, is a hybrid of what's going on right now. So we look forward to it.
And I will say a couple of positive things I've seen out of the Minnesota legalization effort because of the fact that when you look at the indigenous tribes, you know, the chance for, again, talk about social equity, Native Americans should be part of that conversation to get the chance to be able to go ahead and also, you know, open up for business and provide what they can in terms of having their own revenue streams, except for more than just what they have in terms of, like, say, casinos or anything like that, which obviously are just a big windfall for them. And then also the homegrown. Well, we didn't talk anything about that, but I just thought what people were able to go ahead and acquire and grow at home, I thought that's actually pretty significant at what they're able to go and allow at home. But again, will they be able to regulate how many plants somebody might have at home? And, you know, depending if we're going to be in rural Minnesota or, you know, in the city itself. So that's a couple of things that would have to be considered. But I think those kind of things were different. And I think it's also unique to Minnesota and their plight. And I think those are good things. We're going to talk about that. But again, the rollout of the program, the licensing process, the social equity aspect, those are things that are ongoing. And hopefully, you know, when we have you back on, hopefully we'll get some good answers from those. Sarah, thank you so much for being on Blunt Business as always.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. We appreciate all of you for joining us. And we'll talk to you next time.